This is called The Other America, or Looking at Latin America. I'm Evelyn Strang from Texas Lutheran College. That's in Seguin. Hey, thank you. That's in Seguin near San Antonio. San Antonio was founded by the Spanish in 1718. So in a way, you might say I live in Latin America, or certainly in a part of the country where the Hispanic population is very important, where we are learning to be bilingual, and where it's very important for us to try to understand something about our neighbors of Hispanic origin. We're going to look particularly south of the border, and I certainly don't claim to be an expert. One of the things I teach is geography. It's important for me to try to understand more about the rest of the world, and one of the best ways to do it is to try to do some educated travel. Some of you have lived in Latin America, perhaps, or have traveled extensively, but I believe there are some things we can learn by a lot of reading and by keeping our eyes open and by looking to learn more about our neighbors to the south. I think it's important for us as Christian people who believe that God so loved the world that we try to understand our neighbors whose heritage is different than ours. And so it is in the spirit of understanding our world neighbors that this is offered as a look at understanding Latin America as an introduction to it. So we will use slides to illustrate this because I think better with pictures, and perhaps that also may help you. One of the first things we need to recognize about Latin America as a region is that Latin America was settled by Europeans before North America. The Portuguese came to Brazil in 1500. The Spanish came to many parts of South America and Central America before the English came to North America. And particularly south of the border, the Europeans who came found great civilizations. The Europeans who came to North America found some Indians, some of whom had some pretty good things going, although that was not always recognized. But in South America particularly, there were great civilizations which simply must have amazed the country boys from Spain or Portugal, particularly from Spain, when they saw what was there. And all over many parts of South America, particularly, say, the west coast of Peru, there are remnants of ancient civilizations which go back 5,000 years. This one on the coast of Peru goes back 3,000 years. And the whole area is still an archaeologist's paradise in view of the many different civilizations that are recorded there. We're all familiar with the Inca civilization. That's much later, beginning in about 1100, beginning probably on Sun Island, Lake Titicaca, which is the highest navigable lake in the world, well over 12,000 feet. You'll go across it in a hydrofoil. And here the legendary first Inca, the descendant of the sun, was born according to the story. And from these beginnings in this area, the Inca Empire spread, particularly in the 1400s. Their capital city, Cusco, which to them was the navel of the world, must have been glittering with gold when the Spanish conquistadores came over the hills in the 1500s, or came over the mountains, shall we say, because they saw some gold gleaming on the walls of the temple. Well, you know the history. You know that the Inca Empire was pretty well destroyed upon Spanish impact. But the remnants of that ancient civilization are still there. For example, overlooking the hills, overlooking the city of Cusco, is a fortress of Sacsayhuaman, which was so solid that the Spanish could not dislodge the foundation stones, and they're still there. They're very, very solidly built. In fact, that's that remarkable Inca stonework, which has withstood all the earthquakes that they've had in that region. A lot of the things that the Spanish built later didn't make it through the earthquakes. This was Elizabeth, who was our guide at this particular point, who took pride in her Inca heritage. And I think that's an important thing to recognize, that there were great civilizations from the viewpoint of their textiles, of their artwork, of their social organization, of their government, of their roads. For the Inca particularly, their remarkable building, their stonework. There were great civilizations. Their astronomy, for example, their ability to predict eclipses and things like that, was probably better than that of the Spanish who conquered them. So people like Elizabeth, whose heritage is Inca, are very proud of that heritage, even though their people were conquered, and they feel a little bit like the Europeans misused them. In Cusco, for example, you can see what is true in much of Latin America, that one civilization is built on another. The base of these buildings is pure Inca stonework. The upper part is Spanish colonial, as you can notice. And here again, the background of this was an Inca palace, Inca stonework. The foreground is surely Spanish colonial. So it was the Europeans putting their layer of their kind of civilization over an earlier civilization that was there. One of the most fascinating reminders of an early ancient civilization is Machu Picchu, the sacred river of the Inca, which eventually runs into the Amazon basin, the valleys which the Inca had cultivated, of course, in a kind of a feudal system where the head Inca at the top of the empire controlled all of it. And then away, way up a mountainside to the lost city, Machu Picchu, the city in the clouds. The Spanish destroyed much of what they found because, since it was not a Christian civilization, they thought it was heathen. They thought it had to be destroyed. You may know the story. They asked the head Inca, the emperor, to be baptized. They told him that if he would be baptized as a Christian, why, they would save his life. And he could still rule. He was baptized, and they killed him. So there was a lot of treachery in the conquest. The Inca Empire was probably at its peak when the Spanish came in. How could a few conquerors topple a great civilization? Well, because this great civilization had also been pretty cruel in extending itself, overextending itself, it had made some enemies. And because it was so strongly centered under a person who was deemed almost divine, when the head of the empire fell and was killed, a lot of the organization just sort of fell apart at a strategic time in history, one of those accidents of history that a few not too well educated people from a somewhat superior technological society in terms of weaponry could topple a great empire. But it happened. But the remnants of that great empire, the terraces on the hillsides, I think there's a yama up there someplace, the remarkable stonework, the remarkable building, are still there to show us of the grandeur of the past. Of course, some of this was conscripted labor. A lot of the peasants who did this kind of work probably didn't choose to do that. But it was well done, built solidly, as a reminder of one of the great civilizations. In Middle America, the Mayan civilization also is a reminder of great things of the past. However, the Maya were really not defeated by the Spanish. The Mayan civilization had started to fall in among upon itself before the Spanish came. You can read articles about what caused the collapse of the Maya. It may have been environmental factors, misuse of land, overpopulation, whatever. But anyway, there are still reminders of this in museums and also of other civilizations, the Aztec, the Toltec, and so on. This is in Mexico City. So our neighbors to the south have a heritage of ancient civilizations that is more splendid than anything in North America. And some of them are pretty proud of that great civilization. Some of you may have been to the pyramids, Teotihuacan, near Mexico City, for example. They're pretty impressive and pretty well built. And that was before the Aztecs. So there were some things going south of the border that probably are much more impressive than anything north of the border. And the people are proud of that. And we need to remember that in understanding them and what went on there. For example, at the Zocalo, the central plaza in Mexico City, they are again unearthing new monuments and new reminders that the present cathedral and plaza is built on an earlier site, Aztec site, and some older sites. And I was told recently that a lot of this area of downtown Mexico City, again, is being dug up because they're still finding new things, reminders of past civilizations. Part of the great heritage that they're now treasuring. Another thing that's different about Latin America is the population composition, as far as who the people are. In our country, north of the border, the Indians who were here were pretty well pushed back, exterminated, whatever, or driven into reservations. They do not form that large a proportion of the population of the United States. Certainly they are significant and important, but percentage-wise, American Indians are not that large a proportion. In Latin America, some countries have a majority of people who are pure Indian. These boys would have a heritage of pure Indian of Inca, for example. Their ancestors would have been of that group. Some of them still choose to wear Indian garb. Now, this person is doing it on Lake Titicaca in the old reed boats, which they still use on Lake Titicaca. He's doing it perhaps for tourists because he's trying to get a little bit of money. But these women are still wearing their traditional Indian garb. Normally, the Indians are barefooted. It gets cold in the high mountains of Peru and Bolivia and so on. And yet, that is their garb. So that in countries like Peru, about 45% of the people will be Indian, and another high percentage will be mestizo, mixed Spanish Indian. But the percentage of Indian in the general population of many of the countries is much higher. In Bolivia, for example, the most Indian, many of the people live in very simple conditions. This is on the Altiplano, the high plains of Bolivia near Lake Titicaca. Very difficult life, and cold and wet and so on. And we are reminded that the civilizations that made it here made it at unusual conditions. You don't normally have a lot of people living above 10,000 feet elevation or more. But on the Altiplano of Bolivia and Peru, you have a fairly high population density considering the elevation for 10, 11,000 feet. And La Paz, Bolivia illustrates this contrast with so many of the people still holding on to the Indian heritage. This is supposed to be the oldest or the biggest of the Indian markets in Latin America, the market in La Paz, Bolivia. And the Indian people there will be very camera shy. You respect them and you try and you don't take a picture head on. Of course, some of us are a little treacherous and may catch someone from the back. But there are also a few reminders of what they have contributed. We think about potatoes, and we think about potatoes as Irish potatoes. Potatoes are indigenous to the Andes. The freeze-drying processes were first developed by these people. Those things in the sacks include all kinds and varieties of potatoes. And because it freezes on the Altiplano at that high elevation almost every night, a long time ago they learned to take the different varieties of potatoes that they had developed, stomp the moisture out with their feet, and that left a sort of a freeze-dried potato. The potato comes from that region. So that from that culture came some other things which we don't have time to name. But the Indian-ness of Latin America in many countries is significant, particularly the Andean countries. Ecuador, this is in Ecuador, an Indian woman trying to hack out a little roadside garden on the very steep hillsides, Peru, Bolivia, and particularly is very Andean. There is social stratification, and the Indian is always going to be at the bottom, someplace along the line. Many of the Indians do not speak the language of the country. In Bolivia, about 35% of the people have an Aymara heritage. And I've known missionaries, some Methodist missionary friends, who went to the Aymara in Bolivia, for example. Or Quechua, the language that is a descendant of the Indian Inca language, is spoken by many of the people in Peru. And so there will be various tribal languages, so that education very often does need to be bilingual. But you can see the poverty of many of the people. Notice the sign, the Coca-Cola sign. And the Indians, in some cases where they have land, are making it. They will have their own markets where they will trade goods with each other, primarily barter. Each particular area in Ecuador will have its own market day, so that what is produced in one particular village will be traded with another village that will specialize in something else. Now, where the Indians have had a chance to keep the land, where they have never really been conquered, they are making it. In most cases, they were conquered or pushed off the land, so most of the Indians are not making it. But in north of Quito in Ecuador, there is a region, the Imbaya Indians, or we usually call them Otavalo after their main trade center. They were never really conquered by the Inca Empire. They were never really conquered by the Spanish. So these people own their own land, and they have a remarkable organization here, where 35 families will elect a chief and then a council, and the council will decide what is planted. It's sort of socialistic, but they work together cooperatively. And they live a little more prosperous than many of the other Indians. They will even have some cattle, which is a rarity, because most people can't afford cattle. That's a very, very special kind of thing. In this case, they have a very lovely setting where to live. Some prosperous fields. They will keep their tribal distinctive things. The women of this area, Otavalo women, they're still going barefoot, like to have that thing wrapped around their head, and they like to wear gold beads. Originally it was gold, now it's gold glass. And they will have their traditional building styles, which does pretty well here. The men like to wear store-bought things coming in, and they like those white pants, even for work. Laundry day in this area. Now, this is a very simple lifestyle, but these people are not starving, because they are able to cultivate their own land, and they make it. By our standards, I mean, no washing machine, no shoes. Well, the no shoes is really a matter of choice there, because they sort of get used to it. This is market day for them, their animal market, and trading different things, dealing, wheeling, dealing, one way or the other, cattle. Now, nobody has a car. But a group, a village, may have a pickup truck. So that's how they get these animals back and forth. And you see the people trudging to market, carrying incredibly heavy loads. Two members of the Ladies' Aid inspecting what they bought here in terms of the different materials. So that by our standards, it's a very simple life. But where they have a chance to do their own land and make their own decisions, some of the Indians are making it. And in fact, these particular Indians are very skilled in weaving. The men particularly are the weavers, and their market, Otavalo Market, is the most famous market as far as tourists are concerned. And they do beautiful things, and they do pretty well. They're prospering. But these Indians are probably the exception. Most of the Indians are not that well off. Nominally, they are Roman Catholic. But surely some of their tribal traditional things are also mixed in with Roman Catholicism. The Indians of some other areas are quite another story. In Brazil, in the vast tropical forest, there are still some tribes, as in eastern Ecuador, for example, parts of Venezuela, tribes which are relatively untouched by civilization. Now, these two little guys are touched by civilization, because we have tromped into the tropical forest and they are posing for us to have their picture taken. They probably go to school someplace and wear different clothes. But still the idea that anthropologists are recognizing that some of these tribes are really threatened by progress. And the attitude of the government, for example, the Brazilian government, in moving into the tropical forest area has been, all right, we want to make progress, we want to clear the forest, we want to put a road through here, let's get rid of these Indians or push them out or something. So a lot of that kind of thing has happened. So anthropologists particularly have been concerned about saving some of the tribes, and not just they've been wiped out by contact with outside diseases and so on. So many of the Indian groups are threatened. They may still do some things. They're fishing in their own way and so on. This is on one of the Amazon tributaries in Brazil. But they will soon be enveloped by, quote, civilization, unquote. Mexico, just south of the border, still has lots of Indians who don't speak Spanish. or any other language than their own. And there's still some remote canyons over here, way over to the right. You can see it from a distance. There are some Indians living here. And they would not speak Spanish. They speak Tarahumara. And one of the unforgettable experiences of my life is coming into this little area at night, a train 6 hours late, and somebody's supposed to meet you, and you land in a village of 2,000 Indians, and nobody speaks Spanish. All they speak is Tarahumara. So this kind of situation south of the border means that there are even people still translating the Bible, the scriptures, into some of the languages. And in this particular instance, in Tarahumara country, people actually living in caves. This child spoke a little Spanish. I asked her whether someone really lived there, and she said, yes, they did. They just weren't there at that time. So the remoteness of some of the Indian groups from the mainstream, I think, is also rather striking in Latin America. And they very often are the forgotten people because they don't seem to be that productive and they get pushed around. All right, in many of the countries, however, most of the people are mestizo mixed, as in Mexico, illustrated here, a heritage of Indian and European, probably Spanish mixture. In some countries, the population is dominantly European. Since we read so much about Argentina recently, you know that's true for Argentina. In Central America, the same thing is true for Costa Rica. But like particularly Mexico and some of the other countries, quite the mixture, the mestizo population. Of course, in Brazil, you have a large black population and various mixtures of Indian black, European black, and so on. And in some of the West Indies, technically also in Latin America, you may have much more of the black population. Another important thing about Latin America that is different is the importance of the church and the history, for example, of the Roman Catholic Church. All right, the population composition is different, and the religious history is different. That often with the conquistadors, the missionaries came in, and very early the church was planted along with the conquerors. Now, there were many very well-meaning missionaries, of course, and the history of that shows that many of them really came to save souls. But sometimes they could not help being mixed up with the conquerors. So that also as the government was planted, European government, the church and the government were linked. This is the Plaza de Armas in Lima, Peru, and the church, not a very good picture, but the church is a church where Pizarro, the conqueror, 1532 that Pizarro came in there. Lima was built in 1535. I think that's older than Jamestown, Virginia, anything like that. Lima is a Spanish city. All right, this is one side of the plaza. The other side of the plaza is the government building the palace. And you see that again and again in Latin America, that particularly the Spanish building style, the plaza, the big cathedral in one place, and the government buildings in another place. And here again is a cathedral, and on the other side are government buildings. So that kind of connection is a significant one. I don't think we've ever had that same kind of connection in our own country to that extent between the church and the state. Now, how strong that link is, of course, depends on the particular country, but that's why a lot has happened in the church. One illustration here, this is not a very old church. I was in Costa Rica in June this year, and this is a church of the Virgen de los Angeles, who is the patron saint of Costa Rica. Many of the countries have their patron saint. You know that Mexico, the Virgen de Guadalupe. In both cases, a miraculous appearance of the Virgin to a poor peasant. Well, in this particular church in Costa Rica, in Cartago, of course, a lot of ornate architecture and so on, but what I hadn't noticed, I was experimenting with outside film indoors. What I hadn't noticed till later when I had the film developed is what you may see if you look. The national flag is to the left there, right on the side of the altar. And that is not unusual, to see the flag right on the altar. My son has a picture of a church in Argentina where the national flag is literally part of the altar. So that raises some questions about what is the link of the government and the church, and how much can the church be prophetic if it is closely linked with the government and protected by the government, as has happened in some cases. So that's another whole story, but we must remember that the religious development in Latin America is different. One thing that's happening because of the history is what is symbolized by this particular monument, which is in Sogamoso, a city about 150 miles north of Bogota, Colombia. In the background is a church, Roman Catholic Church. In the foreground is a monument, and the monument is to La Raza. It's really to the race, the Chibcha people, who had a rather high level of civilization here, almost as high as the Inca, or in some ways more developed than the Inca. And they were sun worshippers. And notice that these two are sort of together. There is a resurgence of nationalism, of the original people recognizing we were something before the Spanish came in. And that's also significant to remember. We don't know much about Latin American history. I certainly haven't studied too much until what I did on my own. We think about these countries as being somebody's colonies. They became independent, most of them, in the early 1820s. This is the home of Simón Bolívar, one of the liberators of Latin America. José San Martín, Simón Bolívar, their idea was to unite these different areas and to make, you might say, a United States of South America. This is a rather remarkable monument that represents the conquest of the Spanish by the native people, you might say, in Colombia. It represents horsemen riding over the crest of the hill and sort of jumping down and routing the Spanish soldiers and winning independence for what later became Colombia. So politically, most of our neighbors to the south have been independent for at least 150 years, with a few exceptions. Economically, it may be another story. We might say, well, why do they have those different countries when Spain, with the exception of Brazil and a few other little exceptions, when Spain was sort of connected with all of them? Well, because they were never developed to work with each other. They were developed to relate to the mother country. And so any kind of infrastructure connecting these different countries with each other was never developed at all. The lack of connectedness, of easy connections, partly because of historical reasons and also because of geographic, natural, environmental reasons, is another thing we need to recognize about Latin America. You know, our country is pretty much spread out, but transportation has connected it pretty well, so we can get around. Getting over the Rockies was quite a chore for the first railroads and so on. We had some deserts to go across. It was pretty difficult. But the country has been connected for some time, and we had great waterways. In South America, in Latin America, in Central America, and so on, the natural environment is much harsher as far as transportation is concerned. There is a lot of desert, for example, in Mexico. This is desert in Mexico, where there is just a lot of the heartland of Mexico that is simply desert with nothing out there, so that there's no particular reason to go across it and to connect it. It was easier even for the Spanish to move out from the west coast or the east coast than to try to go across. So first of all, deserts in some places, also on the west coast of South America, very high mountains, very, very rugged terrain that makes any cost of transportation extremely high. This is the Chihuahua El Pacifico Railroad, which goes to the west coast of Mexico. A fascinating scenic trip, but you begin to recognize the high cost of building a railroad. In a few hundred miles, there's something like 86 tunnels. That costs money. So that for developing transportation, there are some real difficulties. How do you bridge canyons like that? That's in Ecuador. You can if you have a lot of money and technology. But there was no particular reason to connect the country as the conqueror saw it. And so in the development, transportation networks have been costly. And that road is a little hairy. That's in eastern Ecuador, but a little difficult. So first of all, rugged terrain. The mountains there are higher. 22,000 foot peaks in the Andes are nothing unusual. There is no transcontinental railroad in South America that goes all the way across the country. There's no railroad across the country. And when you look at the map, you begin to see why. It's a very, very difficult terrain. Okay, you have the world's biggest river, the Amazon, but when you get off the boat, where are you? You're in tropical forest. So that water transportation has been very, very difficult. So their natural environment is much harder to deal with than ours. This is a highway that's not that far from Sao Paulo, Brazil's largest city, down to the coast, Santos, the seaport. And I think there's something like 22 tunnels and I forget how many viaducts. Very, very expensive road building. You've got to have pretty good money and a pretty good reason to connect the area. That road is way up there on the hillside, and that's a heavily traveled road. So, all right, what helps countries develop? Transportation. Latin America has a number of strikes against it. Desert, mountains, big rivers, historic reasons why transportation networks were never developed. Very, very difficult terrain as far as transportation is concerned. But when the Europeans came in to Latin America, they saw things they were interested in. And particularly for the Spanish, it was mineral riches. And in many cases, particularly Bolivia and Peru, and also in Mexico, and also in Chile, that was what they went in for. Not to help the natives, but to bring the gold, if it was possible, or the copper, back to Europe. When the Spanish came, their government was in need of money, wars. It was pretty much feudal, still a feudal system, so that feudal system was pretty much transferred over here, with a few people running the show and the other people doing the work. This is an aqueduct built at Chihuahua, Mexico, by Indian labor that didn't volunteer, like Holden volunteers. Indian labor that provided a water supply so that some people could live there. And mining villages developed. Santa Eulalia in this area where there is copper, lead, and zinc. And very often, later on, the mines were maybe run by British, the capital might have come from Britain or from the U.S. Now, one of the things that's happened in a lot of the mining areas is that where it was outside capital that developed it, then the country realizes how much of its wealth is leaving the country. And sometimes they have nationalized the mines and say, hey, we don't want all the profit to go out of the country. And, of course, people get pretty upset, and this gets very, very political. But that's also part of the story, that many of these countries were developed for their riches to go out to someone else, and that the people themselves who lived there got very little of it, who lived at a very simple life, very, very poor, in poverty. Also, in Latin America, the landholding system is entirely different. In our country, when a lot of people came, they had their own little land that they could call their own farms. And maybe there weren't that many Indians. Sometimes they had to push the Indians off and so on. But land ownership for the person who would develop the land, the farm. In Latin America as a region, particularly in Spanish Latin America, the hacienda system prevailed, which meant that a few people who came over were given large land grants, and that they could do pretty much what they wanted to. If there were Indians living there, okay, they became sort of the serfs or the peasants who would work for the lord of the manor. And if the people were decent, they would see that they got some food and so on and doled out some clothing. But that the system that developed was that the land was held for status of the owner. You'll read this in geography and history books. It was not so much for productivity and seeing what crops you could raise on it, But having a big spread of land, a large amount of land, hacienda, finca, whatever, was the way to gain status in much of Latin America. So I'm sure you've read statistics how in some of the countries, maybe 60% of the land is held by maybe 10% of the people. In El Salvador, one of the worst was that 2% of the people had something like 60% of the land. So that large landowners, dependent peasants not making any decisions, and the land not used productively. This is some land like that, an hacienda system in Colombia, which is pretty bad about that, where there's still a lot of very large estates, where there's good farmland tied up, but the owner simply has it, well, the family has always had it, it's sort of status, you run some cattle on it, but then there's just a lot of landless people. Which means that one of the things that any government that tries to help his people is doing is some land reform. So you try to get some of these big landowners to share some of the land with some of the poor people, and oh boy, that gets very, very political. And I think we need to understand what happens in land reform. So one of the different things in Latin America is much of the land being in the hands of a few who do not necessarily farm it very extensively at all, much of the good land. Then another thing that developed was the plantation system. When Europeans recognized that here was a place where crops could grow that wouldn't grow in Europe, much of the land then was developed for sugar cane, like in Brazil or the West Indies and so on, or some other crops. This, for example, is a sugar plantation in Mexico, developed later historically by German capital. The sugar refinery here and the sugar cane. Well, this again means that the people who had the land originally, who might have been able to make a living off of it, were pushed off one way or the other, and a corporation, often foreign capital, comes in, buys up or takes over a lot of land, and plants one crop for export. This is Costa Rica, coffee. Now we've heard about the banana republics and coffee republics, where in this case 35% of the national income is from the export of coffee. And we say, hey, that's great, they make a lot of money off of coffee. But what that means is that just a lot of the good land is coffee plantation, where the people who used to live there a long time ago no longer own land. They work as dependent wage earners. If the price of coffee drops on the world market, they don't need that many workers anymore. And so a lot of people then, having no land, have no jobs, and what do they do? So it looks pretty, nice coffee plantations, but whenever a country has so many of its eggs in one basket, like 35% of its income in coffee, there are problems. Or we talk about the banana republics. This is still Costa Rica, banana plantations. Well, again, here is part of the process. The bananas have plastic sacks put around them when they're getting to this stage to keep some of the bugs out. They carry them on conveyor belts into a packing shed here. That's as green as they are. They chop them up individually, individual bananas, wash them and package them and send them on out. All right, these people are making a pretty good living right here. In this case, they're paid fairly well, and so that's fine. But what it does mean then, if the market fluctuates and you find somebody else who has cheaper labor someplace else in another country, you have a lot of people on farmland that could grow other things who do not own land, who are dependent wage laborers, who then can lose their jobs if things change. This is an illustration again where there is good farmland on the slope of a volcano. Here is a group of people working for some corporation. They're spreading fertilizer on this, and they're going to plant either potatoes or onions or something because they had planted that. They do not own their land. They're dependent workers. Much of the land in some of these countries is used for cattle, fattening cattle. Now, we've talked about this before, and we're familiar at Holden Village with the idea that using good farmland to fatten cattle is not getting the most food value out of it. Okay, if it's pretty hilly, it would be a little hard. Of course, they plow with oxen here, so oxen can make it for plowing. But cattle, then, again, owned by some corporation. So the structure of farming in much of Latin America is different. When we hear about land reform, we need to understand what goes on there. Lest we think of Latin America as just a bunch of backward little farms or something, we also need to recognize that some of the world's most glamorous and beautiful cities are in Latin America. They are truly exciting and beautiful. Sao Paulo, Brazil, has over 10 million people, close to 11 million people. It is the largest city in South America, in Latin America. Mexico City is a close second. Demographers say that by the end of this century, those cities, either Mexico City or Sao Paulo, they're not sure, will be the largest city in the world. Shanghai probably is now. But the largest city in the world by the year 2000 will be either Mexico City or Sao Paulo. This is from a downtown building in Sao Paulo, Brazil, looking in one direction and another direction and another direction. So if you've just had a picture of Latin America as little shacks, go to the cities. Now, you did notice that there's not much open space here, because these cities have grown so rapidly and mushroomed that they have not necessarily planned for that. The cities are glamorous, and of course cities mean industry. And Latin American industrial growth has been pretty remarkable. They've worked at it. They have tried to get their own capital, and sometimes they've encouraged multinational capital. This, for example, is a VW plant outside Sao Paulo that employs only 40,000 people. Now, also because they are concerned about controlling some things, they don't call it the Volkswagen or the VW, they call it the Brazil wagon. And what they will do is maybe do some of their own designing and some of their own style, because they don't want to be just run by somebody else, and that's an important understanding. And yet it is the outside multinational corporations that do control much of the industrial development. Coffee port at Santos, export again. They're trying to move from just dependence on one crop agriculture, which was part of Brazil's history of bust and boom, first rubber and then coffee. They're really trying to industrialize, and of course Brazil is doing a good deal of that. But because of the need to increase their gross national product with their growing population, many of these countries are making the same mistakes we did in our own industrial development. You can see some horrendous examples of environmental deterioration. A stream that is polluted, sick, full of suds. Plants that used to be a banana plantation that are absolutely ill from being contaminated by air pollution. I ask our Portuguese-speaking guide here, how can you let this kind of thing happen to your beautiful country, to pollute the streams and the air? And he said, well, we're in a hurry to make progress. And because Brazil is so big, they think they've got much more land to go to, much more space. And right now, pollution is not a big problem. But you can see the air here. This was a very beautiful, clear day. Big steel mill here with air pollution. So there are some environmental mistakes being made as we see it. Certainly in the tropical forest, which is why ecologists all over the world are excited about how the tropical forest is being hacked into. Monterrey, Mexico, beautiful city on a clear day. Monterrey, Mexico, about the same view on most days because it's an industrial city. So in the pace in the race to industrialize, a lot of environmental problems. All right, with the land conditions being what they are, with most of the people being out in desperate poverty, the cities are glamorous. The cities are magnets. Bogota, Colombia, a beautiful city. The contrast between city life and rural life is much greater in most of Latin America than it is in the United States. In most of our small towns, you have all the things you can get in a big city, except, you know, big nightclubs and stuff. You have all the conveniences. But these two places, this little village and Bogota, aren't that far apart, less than an hour apart. So it is no wonder that the landless people, the people not making it see the cities as magnets, as a place to go to. And if you were trying to eke out a living someplace here in Mexico or out here, and you had a cousin or an uncle or someone who had gone to the city who told you about city life and what was there, you too might be drawn to the hope that they see in the city, where it may be desperately hard life out in rural Mexico, for example, or other rural areas. So that, what do these people do when they barely eke out a living? When their schooling out in the rural areas is very, very limited. This school is only 60 kilometers south of Laredo, Texas, in Mexico. It doesn't look like it would have many benefits for the children who go there. And this is only about 100 kilometers south of the border. So, you go to the city, but you don't have the skills to work in the city, you don't know where the jobs are, and you certainly don't have a home. So what happens in many of the cities of Latin America is that any vacant land outside the city is filled with squatters. This is Monterrey, Mexico. On the hillsides will be those tar paper shacks, corrugated iron, anything like that. Usually no facilities in there. Eventually the city may try to do something. And so people hungry for jobs, hungry for hope, come to the cities. They see how some people live. And lest we get the image of most people being poor, there is much wealth in Latin America, a much greater gap between the rich and the poor. And so the rich who have beautiful homes will generally have them surrounded by high fences. This picture was taken through a link in that high fence. And very often they will have walls with broken ground glass embedded in top of the wall to protect what they have, because they are afraid. So that the contrast between rich and poor does strike one much more dramatically than north of the border. The cities are beautiful, glamorous. That's downtown Rio, swinging city. And the beaches and the wealth of many of the people. Look at all the condominiums and hotels in the background. And incidentally, the diverse people. The famous beach of Copacabana in Rio, or another beach, and condominiums. Many people do live well. Many people are rich. But then the poor, in contrast, seem so much poorer. And that is the paradox of Latin America, one of the big gaps between the rich and the poor, even more than in this country. Everywhere, they're drawn to the cities. Manaus, Brazil, on the Amazon, along the river port, industry developing there, sawmills, steel. People come in, little boats, build little shacks, coming in from the tropical forest, looking for a better life. Yes, people, plantation workers, Costa Rica, they had little houses here. But if the plantation is more mechanized, doesn't need them anymore, they too may go close to a city and build their little shacks and hope to find jobs. So here is the problem. We think about Latin America as being overpopulated. The population density of Latin America as a region is much less than that in the United States, in countries of Western Europe. Latin America, from the geographer's viewpoint, is underpopulated. If you would take the total number of square miles or kilometers and the number of people, you would find a relatively low population density. The problem is that they are spread out very unequally, in other words, because the land situation in the rural areas is so desperate. The cities are overcrowded, and all of the major cities in Latin America will have their rings of misery. In Buenos Aires, they call them villas miserias. In Lima, Peru, they call them pueblos jóvenes, meaning new cities. This is Lima, Peru, the hillsides. These are squatters' homes built on dusty hillsides where we actually could see people going through the garbage and looking for food. People so desperately poor in the rural area, no land, no chance hoping for a job in the city. This particular place, as we came along here, this river, this floodplain of a river under the High Lines, no place to build a little hut. Our guide said, I'm quoting, "My God, they were not there last week," unquote. And what she meant by that was that the people, desperate people, in search of a place in the city to look for a job and so on, had simply filled in this whole area in the floodplain of the river. And the Pueblos Jovenes, these pictures were taken by my son when he worked there several times in this area. Here is what you do in a situation like that. There was a Lutheran missionary working in this situation. There were some Roman Catholic sisters running an orphanage for some of the neglected children. Desperate poverty. Here you do see starving children, and there are babies who were there 1 week and are not there the next week. So the other reminder is that in Latin America, we have what we call third world situations, that there are definitely starving, hungry people who want a job, who are hoping for a better life, but because of geographic, particularly because of historic situations, are trapped in things where they really can't help themselves. There are no easy answers for that. I think that we in North America must understand that it is a different situation there before we judge them by our standards, or before we try to run their countries the way we think they should be running them. Travel to Latin America can still be fascinating, but I think as we travel to Latin America, we must have our eyes open. When you see landscapes, remember that much of that land that is good farmland is in the hands of a few people, which means that there are a lot of landless people. When you travel to Latin America, remember that there are some environmental things, volcanoes that erupt, earthquakes, there are some real geographic difficulties, that it is a more difficult, more dramatic environment. It's not as easy to make a living south of the border as it is north of the border, and whoever said it was easy here. And then also we must remember the place of the church historically has been different. When we hear stirrings about liberation theology, that's an exciting thing to learn about, where some of the priests and others are beginning to say that the church must speak to this desperate condition of the poor. After all, Jesus cared about the poor. And so here is where there is some tension also, and something about which we must be informed. So surely, the Christ who died for all, his many children in Latin America, they are our brothers and sisters. And we, as Norte Americanos, we're not just Americans, we're North Americans. They too are Americans. But we, as the Norte Americanos, I think, need to understand our brothers and sisters south of the border, and work with them and pray that they too may be able to live in peace and health and in the saving grace of our Lord. Thank you.